This morning, I'd like to talk about the five hindrances to meditation practice from the Pali Suttas, sutras, the Pali texts. Those are the earliest texts. And they are sensual desire, ill will, restlessness / worry, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And if you practice meditation for a while with some seriousness, or try to practice it with some seriousness, all five of these are going to come up in one form or another, one time or another. And some of you may be more predisposed based on your personality to one or two of them. Some of you may just move between them all. Oh boy. But the point of laying them out as hindrances is also to lay them out as things that you should get to know, that will be part of this process, or have been part of this process if you've already had a sitting practice going for some time. So the first one is sensual desire. And of course, that's a simple one. Instead of just enjoying this activity of breathing in and breathing out on this morning where it's sunny and warm and very dry, we're desiring something else. We're desiring some other experience. And being human beings, we do that a lot of the time. But in our meditation, that's quite distractive and even counterproductive. And last time I talked, I used my daughter and my grandson as an example. Oh, they're still around. In my consciousness, that is. They're not around. But So my daughter is 9 months pregnant now. So that means she could possibly give birth, you know, a couple hours maybe. I don't know. She's in France, so what do I know? she's having a lot of difficulty lying down, because there's no space for her to lie down. She can't get comfortable. All the different postures she tries aren't comfortable. But she has to lie down because she's exhausted. Some of the females in the group may remember this or may have yet to experience this. And my grandson, who's three, is being very clingy right now, because he finally figured out, I talked about this last time, that not only is this baby going to be born, but that my daughter is going to be his mama. And that's the part that was hard for him. The baby was not hard at all, but when he really got that his, you know, he's been clingy, really clingy. Aaron really desires to have some rest, to not be bothered. But because she really cares for him, she is able to put that aside. And that's an important practice with any desire. It's just being able to put it aside. Now, how long can she put it aside for? Well, as long as she tries to do it as long as she can, so he can be there, lying there with her, helping her be even more uncomfortable than she was before. But if she really gives herself to it, if you really give yourself to the meditation, you're able to do it. Maybe not for a long period of time, maybe for a very long period of time. And you keep doing it, and you keep doing it, and you keep doing it. Because you really value, you really treasure the potential of waking up to great stillness, to wonderful stillness. So we have a retreat coming up here at Hokyoji, at our country land, for 4 days next week. 2 to 4 days, depending on how long you stay. And those people commit themselves to, what, something like 14 hours a day of meditation? I never added it up. Well, I guess I have, but I don't remember. I think I used to add it up all the time. I used to add up the minutes. There's a lot of work to put aside, but a commitment that if you spend that much time in retreat, that much time in meditation, that you will open up to some stillness that you generally don't have in your life, to some flexibility and some joy. And so you do it. So we do it over and over again. And during the times I've been leading retreats here, something like 7 years or 6 years, plus the ones I led before I was head teacher, some people seem to have a huge desire to talk. Here we're in a retreat, and that's their biggest desire. Well, it's because it's stifled. There's a retreat atmosphere. There's no opportunity to talk. So I have been talking about this, sitting here in retreats and Sunday talks for 6 or 7 years, and finally people are starting to do it in retreats. Finally, this last retreat didn't seem like there was much talking. Of course, I don't know for sure because I'm not listening in the corners, but it seemed like it. Because it's hard for people to do, hard for human beings to do. For 5 days, not to say anything to anyone, even if there's some instruction you need to give, even if something should be a little bit different and you didn't think about it. Hard. Hard. And the first hindrance, sensual desire, as with the others, sometimes we can't put aside at all. And then when we can't put aside, then we need to just open into it. Just open into the center. Just little by little, open into the center. Which seems to be the other side, but it also is very, very good practice. It can be very effective. So I had a Dharma sister who was here with me at Zen Center years ago, who decided to become a priest, and she didn't like to give talks. She didn't like to give talks on Sunday. She didn't like talks on Wednesday, on Tuesday, and we had to give lots of talks in those days. I wondered kind of why she'd signed up to do it, but she had a deep desire to manifest the way, and maybe she didn't think it would be that big a deal for her after she'd already gone through the whole process of getting ordained, which is a huge process. And she tried putting aside that desire to run, that desire to say no when Katagiri Roshi would ask her, and it didn't work, so she just had to go into it. Had to look at it. See the anxiety. Where the anxiety that usually underlies desire. See where it was in her body. How it manifests itself. How long does it last? Where are the physical sensations? What are the beliefs? Is it about security, about success, about status, about the need for reassurance? For her, it was all those things. It was mostly about those things. But depending on the desire, it could be about any number of things. Or maybe the desire is trying to fill an absence, a vacancy inside, a lack of anything inside. So that's the second way of dealing with this thing. Open up to it. Open up to it. See it in your meditation. See it in your meditation. Kind of takes kind of courage. Takes more courage than putting aside. Putting aside doesn't take any courage. It takes discipline. It doesn't always work, but it doesn't take courage. And if we do this and we have just small successes, then the grip of our desire begins to loosen, begins to just loosen. And the strong love, the strong hate, begins to diminish. And then we have some space in our meditation. Then we remember, oh, that's why I'm doing this. Until we forget it again with our next desire. And that's the process of meditation. So the second hindrance is the hindrance of ill will. Dislike. Yucca. Right? That's become part of our vocabulary. I can remember when it was only kids that said that, but now you can actually find it if you go online and look into the online dictionary. It's true. So, what is it that we dislike? What is it that we have ill will about in our meditation? Well, we may have ill will about our body. We may dislike the way our body's behaving. We may have dislike the person who's sitting next to us, who's breathing like a, I don't know what, like a steam engine. A few years ago in a session, someone came to talk to me in one-to-one meetings. Sesshin is our long retreats, our formal retreats, that is. And they said, I can't, and the meditation hall was full. They said, I want to switch with somebody. And I said, why? And they said, oh, I can't stand sitting next to so-and-so. She's breathing like a steam engine, or he's breathing like a steam engine. This, especially in meditation retreats, or even in 40 minutes all sitting together, dislikes like this come up. Irritations like this come up. For all of us, for everybody. So, can you put that aside? I said to the person, can you put that aside? And he kind of looked at me in a sort of pissed way. Thanks a lot. I'm glad I came in here. Sometimes we can just put it aside. We can just put that dislike aside. That whatever it is, aside. That ill will. That feeling of hostility toward the person, toward the situation. Just put it aside. But sometimes putting aside doesn't work. Like with all of the others, it doesn't work. Then can we be open to it? And can we just open to it? Just, you don't have to rush in when you open to it. It's not like, oh, I'm going to open to it. It's just gently just being with it. Just noticing it. Not rushing in. Maybe you can only open to it for a little while. That's okay. And then coming back and opening again. And noticing how strong the pull is. How strong the pull is. Either to get that thing that we don't have or push that other thing away. And how strong the preoccupation comes with pushing it out, with getting rid of it, with striking it. Sometimes it's very subtle and sometimes it's pretty gross. And of course, if we just fixate on this ill will, on this dislike, our heart becomes constrained. Our mind becomes constrained. We become very sort of cantankerous. And people know that about us, and they kind of don't want to stay around us too long because they just say, oh, cranky. But that's because we've just retreated into our shells, and we're this aversive environment. We don't trust it. So then we shop. We shop for a situation where there's less ill will. And that's okay. That's natural to do that. We shop for a partner who we won't have ill will for. Well, you know, if you make a commitment to a partner, you're going to have ill will toward that partner at some time. And if you want to find a partner where there's no ill will, good luck. Good luck. Tell me about it. Come give me some help. Do Doksan with me. If you're going to find a partner, if you think you can find a partner like that, I'll pay you for Doksan, okay? I'll pay you. Same with a teacher. Same with a sangha. Same with the person you're sitting next to in zazen. So, in Zen, big emphasis on whatever relationship we're with, we stay with it. We stay with it. We open up to it. We see what's going on with the person, what's going on with us, what's going on environmentally. Not necessarily forever, but just until we have really, really opened up, we've really seen it in a non-judgmental, mindful kind of way. And then, of course, what happens is when then we begin to interject our ill will. Then we begin to develop ill will about our ill will, right? And then we say, "Ah, how could I feel that way about him? He's my student. I'm an awful teacher. I should get a new mind. God, how could I do that? I shouldn't even be a teacher." So ill will about the ill will about the ill will about the ill will. It's a human situation, right? So just see it. Just see it. And notice all of the different reverberations. Notice the aversion to the aversion. That's the beginning of lightness. That's the beginning of freedom. That's the beginning of opening up and just fully participating in whatever life offers us. It's always offering us something. So in the fall, last fall, we studied the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta. And it says, it's all about moving our attention, so that we discover where the ill will is, and we work with it. Is it with our body? Is it our sensations? Is it our feeling? Is it our thinking? Is it in our fundamental attitude? And just being there, working with it. And that takes a lot of patience, but if you have the commitment, it doesn't take that much patience. In Pali, ill will is nivarana, N-I-V-A-R-N-A, which also means veil. It's a veil. It's one of the veils. And a veil is something that covers over, of course. So what is our ill will covering over? Is it covering over some fear? Some embarrassment, something else. And having ill will isn't a personal failing. It's just what comes up. Just what comes up. And if we notice what it's covering over, then we've got some good grist for the mill in our meditation practice and in our lives. So those are the first two. And the third one, sloth and torpor. Now, I talk kind of slowly, so some of you may start to feel slothful and torporous as you listen to me talk, especially on a warm day when there's so many things you could be doing outside. Memorial Day weekend, sloth and torpor. So sloth and torpor. What about sloth and torpor? Well, we notice sloth and torpor often when we sit down in our meditation, and we notice it more because in our daily lives, we're so frenetic in our going after desires and trying to push away ill will. So we get exhausted. We get exhausted from that push-pull. And then when we sit down, what we feel, rather than openness, rather than spaciousness, is exhaustion. Exhaustion. How many of you felt that? So that's good. That's cool. That's cool. I mean, it's what one would expect. And it's a little bit discouraging sometimes for people who are beginning retreat, and there's the first morning of retreat, the first day of retreat, and already they're exhausted. But that's kind of what's going on, often. Not always, but often. So sloth and torpor drain vitality, they limit effort, we become heavy, we become lethargic, we become weary, we become weak, all that stuff, right? And the psychological causes are so obvious. Discouragement, hopelessness, indifference, giving up, despair. And of course, sloth and torpor doesn't mean that energy isn't available. Energy's there. It's just that we're not accessing it. So another grandson story. So my grandson likes to ride on my shoulders. And he says, when he wants me to carry him, he says, "Carry you, Grandpa." And of course, I'm just happy, so happy to hear him say, "Carry you, Grandpa," that I just put him on my shoulders. It's fun. Up to a point. But sometimes I wish he would walk. Because he does it so much at the time. Of course, he doesn't see me too often. And when I want him to walk, I say, "Well, Ethan, you should walk. You should walk." And he said, "I tired, Grandpa. I tired." So I put him on my shoulders. So I was putting him on my shoulders last time I was with him. And he said he was tired. He hadn't walked at all when I was the one who was tired. But I'm just happy to have him as a grandson, as a friend. So I was just putting up with it. He said he was very tired. And we were at the park. And I was very tired from just having been at the park there with him and having it. He wants me to do all the things he's doing at the park. Which is, my body is not quite as flexible as his is. On the contrary. And so I put him on our shoulder. I put him on my shoulders because he, said he was tired. And then we walk about 10 feet and we pass an ice cream truck. Well, all of a sudden he needed to get down. He was not tired anymore. He ran around the ice cream truck. He said, "Grandpa, ice cream, ice cream, ice cream." I said, "But Ethan, you're too tired for ice cream." He said, "No, Grandpa, no tired. You have some too." So the energy is always available. Energy is always available. It's based on how we evaluate our situation. It's really based on how we evaluate. If we evaluate it and say it's boring, then we're going to have sloth and torpor. And we're not going to have any energy. And sometimes sloth and torpor is just a strategy for shutting down to prevent something from happening or to resist something. And we all do that at times. But there's nothing inherently boring. Luckily, it's connected often to self-identity. You feel energized when you're something you're working on. You're accomplishing something. You've got a desire that... And you feel energized when you're trying to keep some mean person away, some person who's disturbing you away. But then when self has nothing to do in the way of desire or ill will, then you may begin to feel kind of inert, kind of dull. Or you can feel, sometimes in meditation, you can get bored when you've been having a really good meditation and you've had, your meditation has calmed down to the point that your inner dialogue is not so frenetic. It's not there anymore. The meditation feels kind of easy. Oh, I've got some calmness. And then you just go to sleep. Which is okay. It's all right. No problem. As long as you don't breathe too loudly for the person next to you. But it is something to pay attention to, because sleeping during meditation is not the goal of meditation. Not the goal of meditation. So practice with sloth and torpor. Don't abandon your meditation. Our energy rises and falls for all of us. It rises and falls. Hi, you guys can come on in and sit in there if you'd like. You can do things like get up and do brisk walking instead of this slow, really slow walking meditation that we do. You can do brisk walking, or while the way I have things set up here in our retreats and here at our Zen Center, you can do walking while other people are sitting. You can go wash your face off with cold water. You can adjust your posture. Try to sit more erect. You can take off a layer of clothing. You can change your focus. Lots of things you can try. Sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes boredom is, and sloth and torpor are covering up stuff. Covering up stuff that, you know, you don't really want to look into. So years ago, like 25 years ago when I was sitting here, there was a period in my life in the fall when I was just, every morning that I'd come here, I'd just be kind of like, not asleep, but like three quarters asleep. And I felt dull. I felt like everything was fuzzy, like there was no calmness. It was definitely sloth and torpor. So I mentioned this to my wife. And she said, well, what month is it? And I said, well, it's October, Linda. Come on. I'm absent-minded, but not that absent-minded. And and she said, yes, well, what about October? What happened? Well, October is the month of my brother's birthday, my brother who had committed suicide not too many years before. And so I began to notice that I was also, and she said, and you've been kind of cranky lately, too. And so I was just protecting myself with my sloth and torpor. I was protecting myself from the feelings of anger about his death and toward myself, and the feelings of fear that underlay those. So sometimes sloth and torpor isn't what it seems. It isn't what it seems. And if you go into this with your mindful meditation, you can see it and experience it and let it, in its own time, drop away. And then chronic sloth and torpor. Well, chronic sloth and torpor could mean clinical depression. And if it does, then you should deal with that. Then you should see a therapist, see a psychologist, see a psychiatrist, and deal with that. Or it could mean that you have a lack of meaning in your life. You're not really doing things you deeply care about or really meaningful to you. And then you should look into that. What do you really care about? What's really meaningful to you? What do you really want to do in the short life of yours to connect yourself with the world? So, we can practice with this one, too. Not berating ourselves when we feel slothful and torporousness. Torporous, maybe? I don't know. Slothful is enough, isn't it? and work with it. Work with it as an ally. Each of these hindrances can be an ally. And the fourth one is the hindrance of worry, restlessness and worry. Restlessness and worry. And if you look at different cultures emphasize different hindrances. In American culture, from my point of view, that our hindrance, for the most part, and we have a lot of hindrances, is restlessness. We tend to be, bye. Talk about. No comment. No comment. Restlessness. We're a restless culture. I know that from hanging out with people in other cultures. They just think, you Americans. And, of course, they're impressed with what we've accomplished through our restlessness. But they just, they think, get a life, you guys. Get a life. Certainly the friend, my in-laws are French and Indian, and that's how they feel. And so that's a cultural norm for us, restlessness. And a cultural norm in my family, too, definitely with my father, who was always. And that doesn't mean that restless people don't like to have downtime, but when they're on vacation, they program their vacations. They move from one thing to another. And even if it's just beach time, they program their beach time. And I had a chance to really experience this pretty deeply, more than I wanted to when I was sick a couple of years ago, for a long time. I couldn't come here to sit. I just had to do my zazen lying down. Do my zazen when my body is cold and achy. I didn't even want to sit up. In Pali, restlessness is udacha, and it the translation is to seek constant activity. So, to seek constant activity. So, if you're doing 40 minutes of meditation or a whole meditation retreat, you'll notice sometimes that your energy is just bouncing around. Like you had too much caffeine, but you didn't have any caffeine at all. And that's almost, that happens very frequently in meditation, when you least expect it. And of course, we call that monkey mind, but sometimes the monkey is much more frenetic than others. And then also we can be restless about what we have some great experience of sort of kensho or awakening in our meditation. Then we get restless about that, about wanting to perpetuate that, wanting to get that back. That turns into our new form of restlessness, our new form of agitation. Oh, 10 years ago I had this. Where'd it go? Or 10 minutes ago. So, and as with the others, we just go into it. We just see, where is it? Where is the ping pong ball bouncing in our body? What part of our body is it bouncing from to? What stories are we telling ourselves? And sometimes our restlessness is due to physical pain. Well, then just try a different posture. Don't just limit yourself to one posture. And the other half of this one, of this hindrance, is worry. 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 Well, we all know that. Concerned about imagined futures. Concerned about failures. Concerned about self-image. threatened by shame, by guilt, by regret, all that stuff, right? All that stuff. Worrying about it. Worrying about it. Now, worrying is one that it's putting aside doesn't generally work for. It just you can try it, but it does not work too often, unfortunately. But we can open up to it. We can feel it physically. We can watch where it is in the body and what triggered it. And we can take care of our exercise. We can take care of our sleep. We can take care of our nutrition. We can take care of our behavior to make sure we're behaving ethically. Because all of those things are related to worry. And take care of our physical pain. Physical pain also is a sort of promotes a lot of worry in and of itself. So we can pay attention to those. And those can be the objects of our meditation. And worrying. And then worry too, if it's chronic, it can mean that you have agitated depression. It can mean that you have anxiety disorder. And you should take care of that with a therapist or a psychologist. Psychiatrist, get help, get support. The best thing for worry is not to try too hard. Obviously, right? Obviously. To do your zazen, to do your meditation in really more of a letting go kind of way than a trying way. Oh, no, I didn't concentrate. If you're worrying already, then you've got something more to worry about, which is that you didn't concentrate well, that you'll never concentrate well. You worry about that, and you do. People who are worriers worry about that a lot. And they worry so much they feel like frauds in their meditation. I'm a fraud. My meditation. So, letting go and letting be when the worry comes up. Let it go. And if it won't go, then just let it be. Just let it be. And notice that on occasion, even if you're a worry wart, it's not present. And when you notice that, take it in. Take it into your heart. Take it into your organs. Take it into your mind and your whole being. Appreciate it. There's something more enduring and more alive than all the worrying you've ever done and will ever do. That's the fourth one. And the fifth one is doubt. And this one, since this comes from the Pali Sutras, and the Pali Sutras Pali Sutras are not Rinzai Zen. This is not about the gray doubt. So I'm not going to talk about the gray doubt today. This is just doubt, right? Pali Sutras are very mundane. Very mundane. It's doubt about whether I can do this well, whether I should do this at all, whether I have the capability to stay with this meditation, whether I should try something else instead. And then when you try something else instead, whether that's deep enough or strong enough or right. So it's mental preoccupation, doubt. Mental preoccupation. Indecision, uncertainty, back and forth, back and forth. Most people who are indecisive, it's not just a habit, it's because they doubt. Because they doubt. And it can involve deep inner conflict, which is stirred up by the practice. And usually doubt has some defeatist stories with it. You're telling yourself some stories from the past about not having done something or other or not having been able to do something or other. And so your indecisiveness often is related to those stories. Sometimes it's related to just to not having a good feeling about yourself. You have a feeling that you're not confident. And so if you're not confident in anything, why would you be confident in meditation? You bring that same doubt, that same feeling right to the meditation. Even though you look confident, inside you don't feel confident. So you bring that doubt with you. So it can sometimes strike on your essential feeling of worth and worthiness. And that's hard. That's hard. But that doubt will come up in other aspects in your life anyway. And that doubt you can't put aside. You can open up to it. You can look into it. But sometimes you'd rather not look into it, for sure. And you can do things. You can do things. Other than say, I don't have the capacity to ever get calm, ever attain enlightenment, ever whatever it is you believe, ever. Rather than saying that to yourself, you can say, I have the ability to follow my next two breaths. Maybe that's too much. My next one breath. I have that ability to follow my next one breath. And then you follow your next one breath. Maybe you don't have it. I have the ability to follow the next breath in. Okay. That's where you have to start. Start right here. That's what meditation is about anyway. To start right here. And you can at least follow one breath in. I don't believe that there's anybody here who can't follow one breath in. And then if you can follow one breath in, maybe you can follow the same breath out. Possibly. You can. So incrementally, instead of setting some huge expectation for yourself and then doubting, just this breath, just this effort, this little effort is all that's needed. So those are the five, and if you're a meditator, those will come up, and you have a chance to work with them, and you don't need to be plagued by them, so please don't feel plagued by them. Doubt in particular, I'll say a little bit more about. When we're working with doubt, sometimes we need to work with, other than this incremental approach to your meditation, you need to work with Buddha Dharma Sangha. So what's your doubt? In Buddhism, we talk about the teacher, Buddha, the Dharma, the teaching, the Sangha, the community. So do you have doubt about one of those in particular? Maybe it's about one of those in particular. And then you need to deal with that. Is the doubt about the teacher? Well, then look into that. Look into that. And look into that relationship. Think about it. Maybe dialogue with the teacher about it. That wouldn't be a bad idea. It might be kind of scary. Maybe you don't want to. Dialogue with your best friend about it. And maybe try another teacher, but be careful because this American restlessness is not really what Zen's about. But if there's doubt there, look into it and be a realist. Be a realist. If this situation doesn't resonate, maybe another one will. And the Dharma, you doubt the Dharma. You have doubt about all this Buddhist teaching about suffering and about sitting still all the time and where's deliverance, you know? where's a God to help you? You maybe have doubt about that. So then look at the teachings themselves and see if there's stuff in there that still resonates with you. Still resonates. Go into it. Study it. And if this is not for you, then try another book of scriptures. We've got so many religions in the United States, it's amazing. But don't just be restlessly moving. Really go into it first. Really go into it. Because at base, these religions aren't very different. They're just not at base. They're not. And these teachers aren't very different of face either. And if it's the Sangha, if you have doubt about the Sangha, can this community support you? Can you support them? Is there a place for you in this community? Everybody's behaving weird in this community. Maybe in that other community they don't behave weird. Okay, well, all right. And you look into that before you run over to the other community? Will you just look into that? Look into what's going on with you, what's going on with these other people? And just be with that before you run? And then if you've really looked into that, try another community. But this is about practice and community, the Zen practice. Because we all face these hindrances, and with others, practicing with others can help us. It can help us do that. Help us do that. And help us see these hindrances as doorways into stillness, into quietness, into luminosity. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning. Questions? Comments? Stories? Yeah, sure.
The mind is such a trickster, it tricks itself. I've been reading The Link by Malcolm Gladwell.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about a psychology experiment in which the subjects were brought into a room and they were given a dozen or so sentences, not sorry, lists of words, five words, and their job, they were told, was to make a sentence out of these five words, only using four of them. They were pretty easy to do, and they were timed and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They were performing this task. And then when they were done, they left. Well, of course, that wasn't the end of the experiment, because what the psychologist did was watch them as they left, and somehow or another they had developed some objective measures about the agility of the people, the rapidity with which they moved, other things like that, because hidden in this list of words, they were different words. There was several different lists. One list had words in it that kind of emphasized aging, getting older, so words like gray, wrinkled, that kind of thing. And there was the other list, of course, had youthful sorts of words. And what do you think? I mean, people who emerged after doing the youthful set, they moved rapidly out of the room. And the ones who did the old set just barely got out of the room. So that has something to do with work.
Thank you. Thank you. What else? Hi. The word faith. Well, you need some faith in this in your meditation practice to do it in the first place. There, you need some faith that it will impact your life and impact your relationship with others. And the faith component of the Buddha's path is usually called understanding and intention. And when we lack faith, when I'm so riddled by doubt that I just want to give this up and go do yoga with my wife, which is nice and easy, although it's not always that nice and easy. But I think that, right? Then I have to come back to my understanding, the teaching that we're all connected, and that I can experience that deep intimacy with this meditation if I just stick with it. This deep love that comes from this interconnection. That I can do that. That's the first teaching in the Eightfold Path. And the second one is that then I have an intention to manifest this. Maybe I have the understanding, but I've lost the faith that I can do it. I've lost the intention. I've lost the inspiration. So then I need to hang out with some people who do have that inspiration and get recharged and come back to the understanding and the belief that I can do it. And that's an ongoing process too. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
other people?
Huh. When you tell me what the genesis is, one of the things that keeps me in the trauma is like, they're more in my part of my life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Sitting is like a respite in the day from all that doubt, and all the sloth, and all the torpor, and all, you know, because my indecisiveness is so prevalent in my life that the only thing I can decide on is 20 minutes or 30 minutes on pushing this step. And I like what you just said about, you know, the hindrances can be the doorway to practice. I know that doubt, when you think, I guess when you look at doubt, it was the start of Buddha's travel.
When you look at doubt?
In a way, because he saw, you know, he had that great life, and then when he left it, you know, what happened to see, you know, how old man, illness, and death. He had doubt about that life. And that doubt turned into a little And I like what you said about, I can just sit because, man, that's an accomplishment for me. When I share it with a new person, you know, on Monday morning, man, walking meditation is it, because all of a sudden I can think about feeling the width, you know, like the way my foot hits the floor, the cells in the skin, the bones, the tendons, the muscles, it all comes into act before the universe and I'm lost. My mind races so much that I sit and just pause. That's what I share.
Sure.
All that has brought me to this point is sitting in the cushions at rest.
Sure. Well, and of course, that's, thank you. That's, for many people, these five, meditation is a respite from these five. And these five are more predominant in their daily lives. But actually, if you stick with the meditation, they're all going to come up right in the middle of the meditation. Maybe not in a 20-minute meditation or a 30-minute meditation, but sit with me for a week.
And then,
because they'll be coming up. They'll be coming up there. The advantage of when they come up in meditation is that we have a chance just to see them. We have a chance just to notice them at a distance. The distance meaning that it's the movie on the screen. It's the movie on the screen. And so without the meditation, it's pretty unlikely that the shadow that all five of them cast will not pervade our lives. With the meditation, we bring the shadow right to the cushion. Right, the cushion. We're looking at the wall and we're seeing that shadow. We have nothing but that shadow. And we begin to see the light that surrounds the shadow, the light that casts the shadow, the light that in fact is the shadow. And that's all I have to offer. Now, don't forget, though, that Buddha had great doubt, the Shakyamuni Siddhartha, but he didn't start on this practice just through doubt. It was the last being he saw was a sannyasin. He saw this person who radiated joy. This guy just radiated joy. He didn't know anything about it. He didn't know what a sannyasin was. People always ask me, what's a sannyasin? Well, forget what a sannyasin is. He saw some guy who was radiating joy, just walking outside, radiating joy. He said, oh. And he found out, oh, he's someone who has devoted his life to meditation. He said, well, I have this great doubt, but I want to do that. I want to give my life to that. And whenever he got discouraged during his years, he came back to that inspiration. Some way or another. If he couldn't remember it, he found it somewhere in nature. Because remember, he stayed close to nature. Close to nature. Hard for us to stay as close to nature as he did. Okay. Anything else? Okay.